We'll turn again then in your Bibles, please, to Psalm 36. Now, if you were going to do some serious study on the theme of God's love, then you might immediately turn to a passage like 1 John 4 or Romans 5. You might not immediately turn to Psalm 36, but I think actually it would be perfectly appropriate to do so, because that, I'm suggesting this evening, is the main theme of this psalm that I read earlier in the service and that we're going to be considering together now. Its main theme is the love of God. And that being so then, I would just like to draw your attention to three things this evening. First of all, God's love preserves the wicked. God's love preserves the wicked. So you'll notice then that the psalm begins in the opening four verses on a fairly bleak note. We have there this grim description. And we can identify then several features of the people here being described. Notice, first of all, they are dictated. They are dictated. Verse 1, we have this rather obscure sounding opening line: transgression speaks to the wicked. Now, as I say, for us in our English versions, it's rather obscure. In the Hebrew Bible, it's actually a very striking phrase. There's a recurring phrase throughout the Hebrew Old Testament, which is literally utterance of Yahweh. Utterance of Yahweh. And it's often translated in our Bibles, declares the Lord. So you have Ezekiel or Jeremiah, or another of the prophets, delivering some definitive, authoritative, divine oracle, and either prefacing it or closing it with the phrase, declares the Lord. But in the Hebrew, it's utterance of Yahweh. And this phrase here in the opening verse of Psalm 36 is very similar, except one word is rather radically changed. Instead of utterance of Yahweh, it's utterance of transgression. Instead of declares the Lord, it declares transgression. In other words, the point is, I think, that these people here being described, it's almost as though transgression, or sin, if you like, for them takes the place of God himself. They take their orders not from God, but from sin. Sin's orders, sin's commands have for them almost the status of divine oracles. That's the point that's been made. It's a bit similar to the one Paul makes in Romans chapter 6. Remember there, he kind of personifies sin, doesn't he, in a similar way. And he talks about people being slaves to sin. And it's the same kind of idea then. Sin as a master that commands, do this, do this, do this. And that's the point that's being made here. These people that are being described in the opening paragraph of our psalm, they are dictated by sin. Sin is their master. Sin is their God. Sin speaks and they do. They are dictated. Secondly, they are deceived. Verse 2, where I think it would be preferable to read, for he flatters himself in his own eyes so that his iniquity cannot be found out and hated. In other words, he flatters himself so much in his own eyes that his iniquity cannot be seen or detected even by himself. That's the point, I think. These people that have been described are so infatuated with themselves. They're so in love with themselves that the idea they might have iniquity in them, the idea they might be sinful, it just never begins to cross their minds. They have flattered themselves so much. They have built themselves up so much in their own perception. Their self-image is so wonderful that the idea of them being sinful just never even appears on their radars. So they are dictated, they are deceived. Thirdly, notice, they are deteriorating. They are deteriorating. Look at verse 3, where we read there in the second half of the verse that they have ceased to act wisely and do good, implying then a deterioration, a regression. Now, I don't think it's saying that these people here being described, that once upon a time they were really wise in the full biblical sense. The kind of wise that we encountered in Proverbs 1 in our reading this morning. Wisdom which begins with the fear of the Lord. It's not saying that once they were wise in that fuller sense and they've somehow managed to fall away from that. But there is a lower level, common grace kind of wisdom, isn't there? You can see it sometimes in your colleagues at work, in your neighbours, your friends who aren't Christians. They nonetheless display at times a certain degree of wisdom, which is nothing to do with the Holy Spirit having regenerated their hearts. It's a general, common gift of God's grace. And it seems then that these people here being described, for a time, some of that is apparent in these people, but then as they go on, the wickedness in them becomes more entrenched, becomes more pronounced, it deepens, so that even what common grace wisdom they have is increasingly evaporated and dispelled. That's the direction that these people here described are going. They are deteriorating morally. That's the point in verse 3. So they are dictated, they're deceived, they're deteriorating. And then fourthly, notice they are damaged. They are damaged. Look at that striking last phrase of verse 4. He does not reject evil. We human beings have immune systems, don't we, to reject disease. And if they don't do that, then there's something seriously damaged about them. We have coughing reflexes, don't we? So that if a rogue crumb goes down your windpipe, then it's rejected. And again, if that doesn't happen, if that rejection doesn't take place, there's serious damage somewhere. And similarly then, we human beings have consciences, don't we? To reject evil. Evil suggestions, evil ideas, evil temptations. When we come into contact with evil, we have these consciences that are supposed to reject that evil and repel it. And if that doesn't happen, then we are seriously damaged. There's some damage. Some serious damage in our consciences. And that's what is the case with these people. They don't reject evil. Their consciences are seriously damaged. This part of them, which God has put in them, precisely for that reason, to reject evil. Their moral compass, to use the more fashionable modern term. It's damaged, and it's not doing what it's there to do. So that's the fourfold description then that we have in these four verses. These people that David begins his psalm talking about, they are dictated, they are deceived, they are deteriorating, and they are damaged. And now, of course, we must ask the question then, well, who are they? Who are these people that are here being described in such bleak terms? Well, it seems to me there are two possibilities. When you read the book of Psalms as a whole, there are two possibilities. On the one hand, these could be specific people that David has in mind. They could be specific enemies of his, who at this time, as he writes this psalm, are pursuing him and giving him a hard time and causing him grief. We come across similar-ish descriptions of people in the Psalms, and they are clearly his enemies. They are those who are making life very hard for David as he writes the psalm. So it's possible that that's the identity of these people in verses 1 to 4. Or it's possible that this is a more general description of mankind. A bit like what you have in Psalm 14 and in one or two other places in the Psalms. That the psalmist here is simply describing the human condition. And it seems to me that it's the latter. That David isn't here talking about specific people who are harassing him at this point. He's rather talking about mankind's general, natural condition. I say that for two reasons. First of all, go again to verse 1. And you'll notice that there's an alternative footnote reading in the ESV. Instead of transgression speaks to the wicked deep in his heart, transgression speaks to the wicked deep in my heart. Now that sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? But precisely for that reason, it's probably more likely to be genuine. You can't really imagine some scribe copying the psalms here, copying this psalm and changing this from what originally said his heart to my heart. But you can imagine a scribe copying what originally said my heart to his heart, because he just thought, well, my heart doesn't make sense, it must be his heart. So I think the harder reading, the more odd reading, is often the more genuine one, and probably is here. And I think David is probably just hinting that he himself knows something of this being dictated by sin from his own experience. This isn't just a group of enemies of his that he's describing and kind of lamenting their condition. This is a description of the human race of which he is a part. And so he knows a little bit of what this is about. He said, it's happened in my heart. I can remember a time when sin dictated me, when I did exactly what sin told me to do. I know what this is, he's saying. And then the second reason is that Paul quotes verse 1 of Psalm 36. There is no fear of God before his eyes bit. Romans chapter 3, verse 18. He cites that. And he does so then in a context where he is arguing for general human depravity. He's almost at the great climax of his argument in kind of from chapter 1:18 to chapter 3:21. And he's almost at that point where he will announce that the whole world then is accountable to God. And in that context, he uses this as one part of his evidence, Psalm 36, verse 1. And I think we can probably generally suppose that Paul knew the scriptures he was quoting from and used them with integrity. And so it's likely then, for that reason too, that David here is giving a general description of mankind. So, I'm saying then that these first four verses of Psalm 36 are simply describing the human race. They're describing the basic human condition. Most of you, I'm sure, can accept that. Perhaps some of you don't. Perhaps you've bought into the contemporary philosophy in our society that human beings are essentially good. Essentially good. The Bible says, no, that's not the case. This is what we're like. This is the human condition. It's devastating, isn't it? But that's what the Bible consistently says. But this is the question then. That being the case, if the human race is as described here in these four verses, what would you expect God to do with it? Well, surely you would expect God to walk out on it. You'd expect God to wipe it off the face of the planet. How can God do anything else with people like this? So dictated by sin, no fear of him in their eyes, so deceived, so foolishly, stupidly deceived about their own moral condition. So set in this path of deterioration. So unable to reject even basic wrong, basic evil. Surely God is going to finish off such a race. That's what you would have to conclude, isn't it? But then we come to verse 6, where instead we have those phenomenal words at the end of the verse, man and beast, you save, O Lord. Now, save is a good literal translation of the Hebrew, but I think probably for us it has connotations that are absent here. It's not talking about salvation in the sense that we normally think of salvation. And that's why all the other versions, I think, have preserved there. Man and beast, you preserve, O Lord. You sustain, you give life to. You allow to live, you enable to live on planet Earth. You don't wipe them off the face of the planet. You give them continued life and breath and existence. That's the point that David is making. And at one level, perhaps there is a slight derogatory note, the fact that he just lumps together man and beast in the one phrase. I think that happens 23 times in the Old Testament, and almost always it's in a negative context. It's in context of judgment and God being displeased with man that we have the phrase man and beast occurring. And of course, if you think prior to the fall, it would have been inconceivable, wouldn't it, to just lump together man and beast in the same phrase like this. Because God made man and beast so massively distinct. Man in his own image. And indeed with the role of governing, ruling the beasts. They were poles apart. There was a massive gulf between man and beast before the fall. But since the fall, that gulf has been reduced somewhat. And there is a bestiality about man's behavior, dictated and deceived and deteriorating and damaged in the ways we've identified. So that there is perhaps a slight derogatoriness in David just lumping the two together here, man and beast. So at one level, there's perhaps a hint of that, but at another level, and mainly, David is saying, isn't it extraordinary that God should preserve human beings who are like verses 1 to 4? Isn't it extraordinary? Instead of wiping them off the face of the planet, he should provide for them, keep them, sustain them. What a phenomenal thing. And what's the explanation then? Why on earth would he do that? Well, the answer David gives is simply God's love. God's love. That's why the paragraph there begins with it, verse 5. Your steadfast love extends to the heavens. And I think then that the second half of verse 5 and the first half of verse 6 could almost be placed in brackets, and I'll come to that a little later on. But it's almost a parenthesis, I think, so that really David is saying, your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, and then he jumps to the end, man and beast you preserve, O Lord. It's because of your love, this preservation of wicked, wicked, wicked human beings is explained simply and solely by your amazing love. And we need to pause on that, don't we? We can so easily overlook it. We're increasingly conscious, I guess, aren't we? In Great Britain in 2014, increasingly conscious that we're in a Romans 1:18 situation. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. We see, don't we, human beings, in Paul's language there, being given up to dishonorable passions, exchanging natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. We're very aware that we're in a Romans 1:18 situation. But let's not forget that at the same time we're also in a Matthew 5:45 situation. God makes his sun rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. We see those very same human beings who, because of God's wrath, are being given up to dishonorable passions. We see those very same human beings, because of God's love, having food to eat every day, having water to drink, having clothes to wear, jobs to do, houses to live in. That's the amazing love of God that David is talking about here. This universal love. This love which preserves the wicked. So that's the first thing we notice in our psalm this evening. God's love preserves the wicked. Secondly, notice God's love befriends the wicked. God's love befriends the wicked. Because as David moves into the next paragraph at the beginning of verse 7, it's clear that God's love is still his theme. That's how he begins, talking again about God's steadfast love. But as you read that paragraph, verses 7 to 9, it soon becomes clear, doesn't it, that we're talking now about a profounder level, a profounder expression of God's love. We're no longer merely talking about God's love preserving the wicked. We're talking about God's love going further here. We're talking about God's love reaching out in friendship, reaching out in reconciliation, reaching out in restoration. We're talking about a befriending love. And I think we can identify three stages in this love then. First of all, God shelters them. God shelters them. Verse 7 then, this reference to the children of mankind taking refuge in the shadow of your wings, which raises the question then, refuge from what? The word implies some kind of threat, doesn't it? It implies some kind of danger. And what then are these people taking refuge from in the shadow of God's wings? And I think the answer is they are taking refuge in God's wings from God's wrath. From God's wrath. You know, it's you might wonder where I'm going with this for a moment, but it's not universally accepted by Bible scholars that Passover, there in Exodus 12, Passover is really Passover, that's the best translation, that's the best word to translate Exodus 12:13, I think it is. This idea then of what God was going to do with regard to the Israelites that night before they came out of Egypt. Certainly there's another word that he was going to pass through, the angel of death was going to pass through the land, that's fair enough, but what was God actually going to do to the Israelites that night? The Israelites where the blood had been shed, where the blood was around their door frames. What precisely was he going to do to them or for them? And the traditional understanding then is that he was going to pass over them. But as I say, that's not universally accepted. And it seems there are good reasons to believe that the word that is translated in most of our versions, probably all our versions, Passover, it has ornithological associations. It's about birds and what birds do. And particularly then the hovering action of a bird. Certainly in another place it's used in that connection in Isaiah 31 and verse 5. Isaiah talks about, he says this, like birds hovering, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it. He will spare and rescue it. And the word spare there is the same word translated Passover in Exodus 12:13. But there you clearly have this idea of the Lord hovering in protection. And It seems then that there's good reason perhaps to suppose that actually what God is doing there in Exodus 12:13, for those Israelite homes where the blood is, he's actually not passing over them, he's hovering over them. He's covering over them. One writer puts it like this, he says, the picture in Exodus 12 is not one of God's passing over his people, but of his coming to them and abiding with them through the dark night of judgment on Egypt. Like a hovering bird spreading its protective wings over its young, the Lord covered the Israelite houses, keeping watch over them. He was their gatekeeper, their guardian against the entrance of the angel of death. So the blood had been shed. God's wrath had been poured out on a substitute, the lamb that had been slain. And that having occurred on the night of judgment, God himself protected those Israelite homes so that they couldn't receive the wrath. They couldn't receive the punishment. And I think it's interesting then to come to this part of the book of Psalms. I remember I said last time, I think, that we must never think the Psalms are a kind of random collection, in terms of the order, I mean, that they've been kind of randomly put together. There's definite order and arrangement evident in the book of Psalms. Now, I remember, probably about 3 weeks ago now, we were in Psalm 34. And remember in Psalm 34, verse 20, we had a reference there, didn't we, to Exodus 12. A quote from Exodus 12, or an allusion to Exodus 12, in Psalm 34, 20. He keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. Remember that in Exodus 12 is about the Passover lamb. The lamb whose blood was slain, none of its bones were to be broken. So there in Psalm 34, 20, we have the sacrificial, substitutionary blood, the sacrificial animal being referred to. And I wonder then whether here now in Psalm 36, verse 7, we have the other aspect then of what happened that night in Egypt. We have God protecting, covering over, hovering over those for whom blood has been shed. And because blood has been shed, ensuring that wrath cannot fall upon them. And so that's, I think, the sheltering here in verse 7. These people are taking refuge not from some temporal passing disaster, but from the wrath of God, which they deserve because of their wickedness described in verses 1 to 4. The sacrificial blood has been shed, and so now God brings them under his wings and protects them. So God shelters them. Secondly, God renews them. He renews them. Because here then we have David writing this psalm, and David then is by nature in the category of verses 1 to 4. We've said he hints at that himself, deep in my heart, verse 1. David is by nature as much characterized by the human condition as anybody is. And yet, David now in Psalm 36 is saying things like verse 7, how precious is your steadfast love, O God. David is a man who naturally is in the verse 1 category. There's no fear of God before his eyes. But something has happened to David. He's been renewed. His whole attitude, his whole mindset has been renewed. So that now the God who once meant nothing to him now is an obsession to him. And he finds this God thrilling and precious and beautiful. This is what I was referring to a moment ago when I talked about the parenthesis, the brackets that should perhaps be there in the previous paragraph from the middle of verse 5 to the middle of verse 6. I think that we have David almost given a kind of Paul-like digression here. His main point is God's love. That's what he's talking about. That's his argument. His love. God's love is the main theme of the psalm. And he doesn't really need to go into God's other characteristics in terms of his arguments. But it's almost as if David can't help himself. Like when you're talking to to someone who's fallen in love with a woman. And, you know, you ask a perfectly innocuous question, you know, what does she like doing in her spare time? And so he kind of answers that and takes about 10 minutes doing that. And then having told you what she likes doing in her spare time, he then says, oh yeah, and have I ever told you about her sense of humor? I mean, it's just amazing. And he goes on about that. And then, have I ever told you about the color of her eyes? And so he goes on, and he just can't stop himself. And here's David, and he's so obsessed with God. He's really talking about his love. But then he says, well, hang on a minute. Have I ever told you about his faithfulness? That's just as big as his love is. Have I ever told you about his righteousness? That too is colossal. And so he goes on. This man has been renewed, and he's obsessed with this God. God shelters them, God renews them, and then thirdly, God cherishes them. The beautiful language of verses 8 and 9. In verse 8, God is pictured as a kind of lavish host, isn't he? It's almost Charlie and the Chocolate Factory stuff. You know, you have that river of chocolate flowing through the factory, and here then we have God hosting these friends. And it's not simply that waiters are going round with bottles constantly filling up drinks, but there's actually a river of delights. There's a river of the most delightful drink kind of flowing through the middle of this house where God is hosting his friends. And then verse 9, with you is the fountain of life, in your light do we see light. I think your light there is probably an abbreviated form of a more common expression in the Psalms, the light of your countenance, or the light of your face. That's in Psalm 4, verse 6, Psalm 44, verse 3, Psalm 89, verse 15, and Psalm 90, verse 8. And the idea in that phrase, the light of your face, it's the idea then of just of God smiling. God's face being radiant, a beaming face. You know the beauty of that at a human level, don't you? You know, you've wronged someone, or at least you've offended someone, and you try to address this, and you apologize if you have wronged them, or you explain if you've simply offended them without meaning to. And sometimes that person may just kind of give a cold handshake and mutter, yeah, it's all right, and walk away. On other occasions, that person might smile. Say, yeah, that's fine, don't worry about it. And the smile means so much. And here, David is talking about the smile on the face of God. And he's saying, in your light do we see light. In other words, I'd never seen a smiling face till I saw yours, God. Yours is the ultimate smiling face. And so these are the three stages of God's befriending then of wicked people. He shelters them from his wrath. He renews them, gives them a new love for himself, and he cherishes them. He enters into an intimate relationship with them. Now, this is the thing. This befriending love, of course, is not universal like the preserving love we considered first this evening. That preserving love is universal, isn't it? Look across the planet, and wicked men and women are being preserved by God. But not all human beings experience this love. God sheltering them from his wrath under his wings. God renewing them. God cherishing them. It's a particular love. It's a discriminating love. It's a love which some experience and others don't. I wonder, do you know anything of this love tonight? This befriending love of God. Has he sheltered you from the wrath that must fall on you if he hasn't? Because you're in the category of Psalm 36, 1-4. Has he renewed you so that tonight you're just obsessed with God? Has he cherished you? Are you in a daily, intimate relationship? He's your host, feeding you with delightful delicacies every day. If not, cry out to God tonight. Say, thank you, God, for your preserving love that has kept me alive till this very moment. Please befriend me, God. Cry out that to him. even this evening. So God's love preserves the wicked, God's love befriends the wicked, and then thirdly and briefly, God's love frustrates the wicked. God's love frustrates the wicked. And I'm talking here then now about those who remain in their wickedness, the wicked who remain in their wickedness and aren't befriended by God in the way we've just been describing. Notice in verse 10, David prays there, so continue your steadfast love. Continue it, maintain it, cause it to keep on going. And you notice that this is not just a kind of an idle, meaningless, casual prayer. There's a note of urgency about this because he then goes on in verse 11, let not the foot of arrogance come upon me, nor the hand of the wicked drive me away. In other words, David is worried here. David is aware, I think, that now that he loves God, he is necessarily a target for those who are still in the verses 1 to 4 situation. Those who still have no fear of God before their eyes. They hate him because he now loves God. Because he now has this obsession with God. There are many who hate him because of that. And he feels threatened by them. And he's concerned then, in the language of verse 11 there, that these people might drive him away, or in Paul's language in Romans 8 that we read earlier on, that they might perhaps separate him somehow from the love of God. These people who hate him, who are targeting him, that somehow they might be able to rip David away from the love of God. And that's why he prays desperately, urgently, continue your steadfast love to me. Maintain it. Persevere in your love to me. And this is the thing that you notice, that sure enough, as the psalm closes in verse 12, David is assured that God's love will keep him. And that in fact, these people who hate him, these people who want to separate him from God's love, they finally will be thrust down and able to rise. Their desires to drive David away from the love of God will ultimately be frustrated. And perhaps tonight, again in Britain in 2014, you're increasingly conscious of the massive change in our society's attitude that is taking place so rapidly. The way in which Christianity, once so much at the heart of our society, is increasingly not just on the fringes, but actually disliked. And actually vilified. And perhaps you're beginning to feel, as you read the newspapers, as you watch TV programs, you're increasingly beginning to feel a hated, part of a hated group, a hated constituency. And perhaps that worries you, that there are those who hate Christians out there. And there are, aren't there? What if they separate me from the love of God? And David and Paul are one in reminding us this evening that it can't happen. That God's love, we cannot be separated from God's love. Not by anything, famine, nakedness, persecution, anything. Nothing can separate us. Those who would want to do that will be frustrated. And we will, as we heard last week so eloquently, we will be preserved and swept along by that wonderful love till finally we arrive safely home. Be assured of that this evening. Amen. Well, let's just close singing a couple of stanzas.